Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast. For the week of Monday, November 29th, I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And this is our weekly roundup of the Division III football season, and we're down to eight teams. The round of 16 had some great games, so we are down to the final eight teams of the 2010 Division III football season. And they are, if you've been under a rock, Alfred, Mount Union, Wisconsin Whitewater, North Central, St. Thomas, Bethel, Mary Hardin, Baylor, and Wesley. And Keith, each of us got to take in one of the eight games that was played this past weekend. But I think that maybe the most surprising of the eight teams that's still alive is Alfred, and not necessarily because Alfred beating Cortland State was such an outlandish possibility that nobody considered it. But you know, you look at the teams that are remaining, and you've got unbeaten teams, and you've got one-loss teams, and you don't have anybody who's lost two games at this point in the season. And Alfred has certainly kind of turned it back on at the right time.
Yeah, you can say that. I mean, the rest of this field, the seven teams, have combined for one loss. That's Bethel losing to St. Thomas, so the only loss is to a team that's still in the field. And then there's Alfred, which has two losses that weren't to playoff teams, weren't even to teams in its conference, which is a fairly strong conference, well-regarded Empire Eight. The two losses, I think, even were head-scratchers at the time, and I'm sure we talked about them on the podcast, Alfred losing to RPI and to Rochester. And they're also the only team that's not in the top 25 that's still around, and they're the last remaining East Region team. So, yeah, there's a lot of reason for them to be called the surprise team, but by the same token, they earned it. They won two games, and they upset the number two seed in their bracket in beating Cortland. And the way they did it is really the theme. I think they follow the theme of the week here. You know, if as we take a look at these eight games, Pat, the theme really is the same thing it is probably every year in terms of how you win in the playoffs, and that's to be able to run the ball and stop the run. And the Saxons got that, their wonderful freshman tailback on track, and Austin Dwyer rushed 32 times for 186 yards, and then they limited Cortland, which rushes for 191 yards per game coming into the game, limited them to 79 yards. It was a rough day all around for the NJAC, and Cortland was the only home team to lose on Saturday, and Alfred pulled the big upset, and their reward, of course, is to go to Mountain Union next week.
Justin Otero, the leading running back for Cortland State, and if you're a neutral Division III football fan, if we threw the names Justin Otero and Austin Dwyer at you, I would suggest that probably more people knew who Otero was coming into the game, and he was held to 18 carries for 56 yards on the afternoon.
Yeah, and he was averaging 120 yards per game coming in, and that was sort of the Cortland MO this season, was to to run the ball and play good defense. And that was the same deal with in Montclair State. I guess they passed a little bit more. They tried to mix in that short passing game, but that was the way to win in the NJAC this season, was to run the ball, play good defense. That's why there were 3-9-1 teams in that conference. And I think the NJAC's image took a little bit of a hit on Saturday with the two losses. Certainly the Cortland loss was the more surprising of the two, being that they were at home, and they were the team that ended up winning a three-way tiebreaker and went into the playoffs considered the conference champion. And I don't know either if we knew what to make of Alfred after the first playoff game. Beating Maritime 60-0 certainly was an eye-popping number, and it was something that everybody noticed in the first round, but nobody really had an idea how significant of a win it was over Maritime, because they obviously weren't one of the stronger teams coming out of a fairly weak conference, and having played one of the lowest strength of schedules in the field. It was just, again, I didn't expect it to be 60-0. In the first round, I thought that would be a kind of a decent game, and Alfred was certainly surprising in the first round, but I think they were even more surprising in the second round, because I didn't expect them to beat Cortland as well as they did.
The thing you mentioned earlier, Keith, about running and playing good defense being key to the playoffs, and I know we've talked about that or variations on that before, and I think some of it is just, first of all, it's good fundamental football, but secondly, it's the time of year, it's the weather, to be honest with you. Not that there was precipitation or anything in upstate New York per se on Saturday, but on a cold day, Some things work better than others, and as you get deeper into the playoffs, the teams that can do the fundamentals well are certainly the ones that have the better chance to advance.
Yeah, I've been gathering this theme, too, over the course of the year, maybe over the course of the past couple years as I talk to coaches in Division III. You know, each coach wants to build its program, you know, with numbers and have, you know, 100 guys or 120 guys if their conference allows, or 150 guys or whatever the number is, come into camp and let the cream rise to the top in terms of finding the 22 that start. But each coach, you know, no matter what region we're talking here, and you know, there's a lot of division in Division III between the regions, and some of it is stuff we cultivate by the way we discuss things. But no matter where we are in the country, every coach is looking for more linemen. And that's offensive linemen primarily, but also looking for big guys on the defensive line that can get after the quarterback. And I feel like just from the numbers on Saturday, you look in the second round where all these teams are fairly elite teams. I mean, every team that lost on Saturday was a team that had a great season, you know, 9 or 10 win type of team. And some of them are from power conferences. You know, when you talk about the Linfields and Wheaton and Ohio Northern and that sort of thing. But every team across the country is looking for linemen, I think. And the teams that get them and teams that put together a good line have a chance to win. And I think the numbers from Saturday bear that out, and we can maybe get into that a little later. But Alfred had great balance on Saturday. And I think anytime you rush for 229 yards and pass for 211, it means you had good balance on offense. But you rush for 229 and you hold the other team to 79, that means your line's played pretty well.
Keith, I'm about to take us on just a slight tangent, and I know we're looking to move on, but you know, you mentioned, of course, everybody's looking for linemen, and I wonder if it's because the kind of kids that would be dominant offensive and defensive linemen in Division III are the guys who get scholarships at higher levels. I know you could say that about a lot of positions, but I wonder if the combination of size and skill that it takes to play those positions is a little more coveted by a scholarship program.
Oh, I think that's absolutely it. And this comes from my conversations with coaches across the country, not just something that you and I have observed, but you're saying when you find a guy that has this kind of the offensive lineman type size, and he has the footwork, the agility it takes to really be great on the offensive line, whether it's to be able to pull or to be able to back up and pass block or to slide, some of the things you need to do on the offensive line, you know, those guys get snapped up. And then there's another level of teams after those Division I teams. There's the 1As or the 2s, depending on where you are, that are coming through with scholarship money and trying to get those guys. And then Division III guys, of course, where, you know, we're selling something a little different, where you're trying to get the kids to come to school for the school and for the academics and also to have a chance to play football. And sometimes the offensive line prospects you end up with are guys that are a little bit more raw, where you may find the size, the 6'3", 280 type of guy, but he doesn't have the footwork, and you have to mold him into a player. Or you find a guy that does have the footwork, but he's a little bit smaller, and he's not your perfect size or your road grader type of guy. So that's really the challenge, I think, for a lot of these teams. And when we get to this point, when we're talking about the last 16 teams in the country, the last 8 teams in the country, Pat, you know, you're sort of nitpicking when you get to the difference between them. And in Division III, we have some pretty clear tiers, because there's a top two, and then there's everybody else, and then there's the everybody else below the everybody else. But all those teams are looking for good offensive lines, and if you can put it together where you have a group that stays together and stays healthy, and you have a chance to get into the second round of the playoffs and face another really good team, you're going to need to get a good effort from those offensive lines, and that bore itself out on Saturday. The winning teams, Pat rushed for an average of 164 yards, and the losing teams rushed for an average of 75 yards. So pretty huge difference between the two, and goes back to that old formula that you mentioned, Pat, being able to win in late November and early December. You have to be able to run the ball.
Mount Union ran the ball to, well, near perfection, 309 yards on the ground on the afternoon, compared to 53 for Delaware Valley in Mount Union's 31-3 win. We mentioned that Alfred's reward is the trip to Alliance. Everybody in the East, as fans, kind of dreads this trip to Alliance. But you know, as teams, you know, you got a chance to measure yourself against one of those elite against one of those elite teams, and are just really, I think, the two elite teams right now. Our colleague Gordon Mann kind of has broken down the football playoffs this way over the past few years, in that there are three tiers of contenders, and obviously there are many more tiers of Division III football teams, but there's three tiers of contenders. There's Tier 1, which are, you know, the teams that are our favorites to go to Salem, and I think we know who those two teams are this year. Tier 2 teams have to play their best to beat Tier 1 teams, and they might be and they might be able to do it even if a Tier 1 team has an off day or makes a couple of mistakes. And a Tier 3 team, basically, in his analysis, could never beat a Tier 1 team. A Tier 3 team could beat a Tier 2 team, given those kind of advantages. And Tier 1 teams against each other, Tier 2 teams against each other, play it pretty straight up. This is probably, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, and I don't think too many Alfred people are going to be upset to hear me call Alfred a Tier 3 team, because I think we've pretty well established who Tier 2 is, about a group of six teams or so. This is a big challenge, is what I'm trying to say, for Alfred to do all this and go on the road at the same time.
Sure, it's a big challenge, but that's what you ask for. And we're so glad in Division III to be able to have playoffs and to be able to sort it out on the field. All the Saxons, you know, you win on Saturday, you enjoy that a little bit Saturday night and Sunday, and then you get back to work and you have one more week of your season. And if you win, you pull the big upset, you know, you have another week of season, maybe two more weeks. And that's the dream, you know, and this is an opportunity to really put your program on the map. You know, there hasn't been a playoff run this deep before by any Alfred team. So they're already, you know, one of the great Alfred teams. And Dave Murray's been building this program towards this, you know, for the past 4 or 5 years, where they were a really good, you know, top half of the Empire 8 team for a few years. And they just couldn't break through to the playoffs. And then they broke through, and now they broke through with a couple of wins. This is where you have opportunity to put your program on the map. Nobody thought in 2004, when Mary Hardin Baylor went up to Mount Union, that they were going to win there. Nobody thought on Saturday that Trine was going to be tied in the fourth quarter at 31 with Whitewater. So, you know, imagine if Trine had held on to win that game, how that would have turned this whole playoffs on its head. Well, we would have been dumbfounded, and we wouldn't have known what to do.
Yeah, and let's,
I mean, that's the opportunity, I think, that Alfred is looking at here.
Do we want to move ahead on to Whitewater? Because that's the question. The question with Whitewater continues to be, well, two questions. One, which we identified right at the beginning of the playoffs, is, what is their what's their pass defense like? What are they going to do against a top passing team? And they have been tested by two of the statistically top passing offenses in Division III, led by two Gagliardi Trophy finalists in Kyle Ray for Franklin and Eric Watt for Trine. And I would say the defense has not fared particularly well. Obviously, then the other question, of course, for Whitewater is, what's the deal with Matt Blanchard, and is he really healthy enough to play? And if so, will we finally see him this week, or what will it take to get Matt Blanchard in the game?
Yeah, you have to believe with it's a thumb injury that he has, right?
Yeah.
So you have to believe with that injury that if he was okay to play at any point during Saturday's game, that when it was 31 all in the beginning of the fourth quarter there, and Whitewater gets the ball back at the beginning of that quarter, you know, if he can play in any way, they would go to him at that point, right? So you figure if Lee Brecky's in the game and they're running the ball, they're sticking with Lavelle Coppedge, that they've seen that they feel like their best bet is to stick with the run, try to win the game that way. You know, Brecky only had 24 passes. He was 12 of 24 for 168 yards and one interception on Saturday. So, you know, Whitewater, on the flip side, Whitewater ran the ball 48 times and only passed 24 times. So I feel like they felt like that was their strongest game and their best chance to win. And they certainly got caught in a back-and-forth battle up and down the field with Trine. You know, it was 31-24 at the half, and it wasn't like Whitewater just came out in the second half, figured out how to adjust, and scored a whole bunch. You know, the whole third quarter, Trine was the only one that put up a score. So that game went the first 20 minutes of the second half before Whitewater put another score on the board, even though they put up 31 in the first in the first half. So I don't think that it was one of those situations where Whitewater was doing whatever it wanted to do, or they had an option to go to Matt Blanchard. I feel like if they had an option and they hadn't been scoring for 20 minutes in the fourth quarter, that they feel like they would have went to him at that point. So clearly there must be something to the injury, and that's something that we're going to have to ask about this week and get addressed. So, you know, by the time, you know, it's late in the week and we're talking about these same issues, looking forward to Whitewater's game with North Central, we'll know what the deal is. And as you listen to this podcast, you know, we may not know for certain, but that's something that's got to get figured out, because if they have to play now, probably clearly their toughest opponent of the playoffs so far, you know, they want to have their best team on the field.
You know, I look at just the play-by-play of the Whitewater trying game, and here is how, after this massive offensive first half in which the teams combine for 55 points, and Whitewater has a 31-24 lead at the half. Here's Whitewater's possessions. Whitewater gets the ball at its own 25 after a punt. Breck is sacked for a loss of 10 yards, and then intercepted on the next play. So it's two plays and a turnover. One play minus 13 yards for the drive. Next drive, after a trying touchdown that ties it up, the kickoff is returned to midfield by Aaron Semplowski. Whitewater goes three plays, minus nine and out. Incomplete pass, two incomplete passes, a couple of short rushes, and a holding penalty. Trine gets intercepted after a couple of first downs. And then Whitewater comes back out, sack, 7-yard carry, incomplete pass, and a punt, three and out, and then a five and out. And then at that point, I would have to think that as much as the problem was the defense in the first half, now the problem is the offense. And not knowing the tenor of the game or anything like that, or having been there, that's certainly an opportunity for the starting quarterback to get back in the game, because that's clearly a sign that the offense is struggling.
Yeah. Absolutely, Pat. Again, those drives, one play for negative 13 yards, three for negative nine, three for zero, five plays for 7 yards. That's four bad drives to start the second half. You know, if you have a spark anywhere on the bench and you're looking for it, that's the time that you go to it. Now, this shows amazing confidence, I think, in Whitewater's plan and sticking to it, and thinking, okay, We've had four bad drives now, but we know we're the bigger, stronger team, and we're going to run the ball here in the fourth quarter. And they were able to do that, taking over at the end of the third, 12-play drive, ate up 6 minutes of clock, gave them a 38-31 lead, and then another 7-play drive, ate up another 4 minutes on the clock and another touchdown. And then trying at that point was two touchdowns behind and was really trying to get back in the game. You know, I don't think this is anything fluky that Trine did. And, you know, if another team down the line is going to get the blueprint on how to beat Whitewater, and it was to the point where I thought, you know, they were far and away the favorite, because we got the word that Mountain Union had kind of been struggling a little bit this year, and Cecil Shorts had been having, had dealt with the foot injury, the toe injury in the middle of the season. There was a point in this season where I thought maybe that the playoffs were going to be fun, but at the end it was going to be Whitewater in a romp. And now I don't think you can say that. You know, you can't even say necessarily that they're going to win this week, you know, until we find out that health status, until we see how they deal in the secondary. You know, they're not facing a Gagliardi Trophy nominated quarterback this week against North Central, but they're going to be facing a pretty good defense, and one that really only gave up 3 points this week.
Well, certainly at that point in the game, Coppedge basically took over. It was the two long drives that you mentioned, Keith, that ended up in touchdowns. Coppedge, incomplete pass, complete pass to Roosh, Coppedge, pass to Roosh, Coppedge for the touchdown. And then the second drive is, let's see, Coppedge, Roosh with a carry, Coppedge, 9 yards for the touchdown. So, Gordon wrote the headline for us on Saturday, Coppedge saves UW-Whitewater, and that's basically how it ended up. He ended up with 300 yards on the nose and basically carried them here in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, Pat, 38 carries on the day. A lot of those coming in the second half when they realized that they have one player on the field who's maybe better than anybody else on the field. And I tell you exactly what it reminds me of. It reminds me of fourth quarter last year, two rounds later, Mount Union playing Wesley, and Mount Union had lost its starting quarterback early in the game and hadn't been able to generate any offense in the second or third quarter. They realized that we have one player on the field that's better than everyone else in Cecil Shorts, and they just pretty much just ran read option the whole fourth quarter and let him finish out the game. Mount Union was able to turn a 10-7 lead into a 24-7 victory. And that's the sort of thing that when you're the elite team, you have that great offensive line, goes back to the theme that we talked about early in the podcast. You have the great offensive line. You have maybe the best player on the field in Lavelle Coppedge. You ride him as long as you can. And it wasn't pretty for Whitewater. I'm sure you asked their fans that were at the game. They say that's not how they'd like to see their playoff games go. But they'll take it. You know, 45-31 was the final. They end up winning by two scores. Got a little bit of a scare. Maybe humble the team a little bit, and maybe they need that this week going up to North Central, because it's going to be another fight. I can't imagine it being any other way, because the way this North Central defense has been playing is really outstanding.
I say one more thing about this game before we move on. Adam Johnson and I were talking on our broadcast of the St. Thomas Linfield game. That this is the advantage that a team has when you have three guys who can carry the ball and split the load during the season, and we saw it with Nate Kamik, for example, in the playoffs when he was the go-to guy for Mount Union, where you don't have to ride him very hard in September and October. And in fact, if you go through the first 7 games, Coppedge has 12, 6, 14, 23, 20, 18 carries, and then a DNP against River Falls. And then since then, he's been the man. 38 carries for 179, 29 for 150, 23 for 114, 20 for 134, and of course, the 38 for 300 on Saturday. And then Antoine Anderson and Booker Stanley combined for just three other carries on the course of the afternoon in that 45-31 win for Whitewater. So Whitewater is going to be facing North Central. You mentioned making the trip down to Naperville, Illinois. North Central, Keith, basically dominant, especially as the game wore on. The scoreboard says 28-9, and that doesn't sound close, and it wasn't even that close.
No, the Polar Bears scored on the last play of regulation to make it 28-9, so it was pretty much a 28-3 game for North Central, and about as dominant, I think, as you can be in the playoffs defensively. You know, limiting Ohio Northern to 220 yards. Now ONU rushed for 140, which was the most a losing team rushed for on Saturday. The only other team that lost and even went over 100 was Wheaton at 104. So, you know, they were able to get a little bit of a running game going, but it wasn't anything outstanding. You know, Kyle Simmons, fairly well-regarded quarterback all season, was 9 of 22 for 80 yards. So they didn't have much of a passing game. And Brent Donnelly led Ohio Northern with 22 carries for 94 yards. And that's only about a little over four yards a carry. And you know, it wasn't anything outstanding. They didn't give up any big plays. And North Central, I think, it seemed, you know, just from afar, it seemed like they were careful on offense, didn't have a whole lot of turnovers, and were able to sort of, you know, just establish their game. You know, they have a nice little passing game to go with their running game, and then let their defense do what it does.
And they certainly ran the ball well on Saturday. 14 carries for 137 yards for Nick Kukuch, whose name I'm going to have to figure out how to pronounce before I broadcast it on Saturday. And the average of 9.8 a carry, and then Jordan Tassio, 17 carries for 111 yards for 6.5 yards a carry. You know, it almost seems like, Keith, we don't really know what the identity of this North Central team is. Although I talked to one coach this week who had gotten hold of some North Central video and tended to agree with the thought that I threw out earlier in one of the earlier podcasts, that North Central may be the top of this second tier, these tier two teams, and basically the number three overall team in the country.
Yeah, and I'm sure Wesley would like to disagree with you.
Sure.
And maybe St. Thomas would too. You know, we'll find that out. And that's the great thing about these playoffs is that somebody's going to get a chance to play these top teams, or somebody's going to get a chance to be the top team. You know, maybe if North Central wins this week, they're going to be the team to knock off. You know, if you knock off the champs, then everybody wants a shot at you. And so, you know, I think we made a big deal, or we meaning the people of Division III, the fans and coaches and also us who cover it. You know, we made a big deal of the seeding. And I don't know quite how much that's going to matter on Saturday. I feel like there's going to be factors that are much more important when Whitewater and North Central play. You know, can either team establish its running game, especially Whitewater, if Matt Blanchard can't play or if he's limited for whatever reason? You know, can either team move the ball on the other team's defense? Obviously, we've seen some cracks in the armor in Whitewater secondary. North Central doesn't really seem to have any cracks in the armor on their defense, you know, playing exceptionally so far in these playoffs, and really has been all season. You know, the other game they played in the regular season against a round of 16 playoff team against Wheaton, that was a 28-6 win. So, I mean, they haven't been giving up a whole bunch of points at any point during the season. And I think a great defense can carry you a far way in the playoffs, but there may not be a better offense when it buckles down and wants to run the ball and wants to establish its will on the defense. There may not be a better one than Whitewater in the country. I mean, we've seen them just buckle up and run the ball whenever they feel like it over the course of several years now, and that's what they did in the fourth quarter on Saturday. So big challenge ahead for the Cardinals, but this is what John Thorne and those guys have been building towards, you know, building North Central to a fairly elite program in the CCIW and in the North region. And now this is their first time in the quarterfinals. They're at home. They have opportunity against the champions. This is what they've been asking for. And all they got to do on Saturday is win.
One of the other teams that won on Saturday was a program that's maybe not quite as far along in its rebuilding process and had almost as far to go when you consider where Glenn Caruso and staff took over the St. Thomas program entering the season 3 years ago, coming off a year that was a dismal 2-8 season, coming to the point where they're now 12-0, reached the quarterfinals of the Division III playoffs, and took down a team that is one of those Division III elite programs, not just based on their history, but based on what they've done over the past couple of years as well. It's not just Linfield is not just resting on its historic laurels or its 2004 national championship. Linfield has been a national championship threat each of the past 2 years, and St. Thomas came away with the 24-17 double overtime win on Saturday.
Yeah, Pat, all four of those teams really in that bracket, Bethel, Wheaton, St. Thomas, and Linfield, have not only been historically pretty good, I guess St. Thomas, as you mentioned, is the one that's sort of new to the group in terms of having playoff success, but, you know, those are teams that maybe if they'd been placed somewhere else in this bracket, you know, that Linfield would still be alive. Wheaton might still be alive. You know, Linfield, maybe the best team that lost on Saturday, you know, took St. Thomas to overtime, had a chance to win that game, and you were there, so maybe I should let you do most of the talking about it, since you saw it live and you watched that drama unfold, and some of us were watching it via Twitter and listening to your audio feed and trying to get any kind of details about it we could, because those are the games that make the playoffs so fun when you have two, you know, top-notch teams going at it against each other, and it's a great game in the fourth quarter and it goes into overtime.
And this game, Keith, was really kind of played in three segments. The first part of the game, St. Thomas came out and scored on its opening drive. They took the ball 56 yards on 11 plays, and a touchdown run to go up 7-0. So we got the first chance to look at the Linfield offense. Aaron Bomey throws an incomplete pass. He's sacked on back to back plays. It's a three and out to the tune of minus 13 yards. Trade a couple punts. St. Thomas eventually puts a field goal on the board near the beginning of the second quarter, and St. Thomas looks like they're really in control. They're up 10-0. Linfield hasn't done very much at all in offense on the afternoon to that point. Two of their drives had been for negative yardage, in fact. Bomey didn't look comfortable in the pocket, wasn't hitting his receivers. Simon Lamson was doing next to nothing in the backfield. Then things switched up a little bit. First of all, Linfield made a key change in the backfield. They swapped out Simon Lamson and put in Taylor Averett. And Averett ran with a different style instead of trying to get around the edge on the St. Thomas defense. He was he ran it more up the middle, ran it more inside, and he had some success. Not enough to move the chains. But then St. Thomas started shooting itself in the foot, basically. Dakota Tracy throws an interception that's returned 50 yards into the red zone. And three plays later, Linfield's in the end zone to cut the lead to 10-7. Next possession, St. Thomas moves the ball a little bit, and then Tracy throws another interception. Drew Fisher returns this one to midfield, and after five plays and 24 yards or so, Linfield kicks a field goal to tie it up at 10-10. And then on the last play of the half, St. Thomas goes into the locker room with Dakota Tracy throwing his third interception in three possessions. Come back out for the third quarter. You know, this is the phase of the game now where Linfield's dominating and certainly getting some help from St. Thomas. But then Linfield gets the ball into the red zone and misses a 30-yard field goal wide left. Dakota Tracy throws another interception. This one's a really athletic play, a great diving catch made by Cole Krieger. First three interceptions were really just poorly thrown balls. This one, the safety made a really good play on. But Linfield couldn't capitalize on that either. Bomey throws an interception. Teams trade punts. We go to the fourth quarter. Game's still tied at 10. Finally, St. Thomas settles down. And one of the key things, I think, that made this happen for Dakota Tracy, the quarterback settling down a little bit, is he finally pulled the ball down and ran and got a key first down at a spot where, you know, this is one of the things that Tracy's pretty good at. His arm strength has gotten better over the course of the year and a half or so he's been the starter, but one of the things he's always done well is known when to pull the ball down and run, and he hadn't done that very much over the course of the afternoon, and I don't know if that settled him down, but after that, it opened up the run game. Tracy hit a couple of key passes, and Colin Tobin, who's technically the backup to the guy, Ben Wardman, who's the Gagliardi Trophy finalist, Tobin's been playing just as well as Wardman, if not better, over the past 6 weeks of the season, and he finishes off that drive with a 12-yard touchdown run, and St. Thomas goes up 17-10. So we're about midpoint of the fourth quarter now. So Linfield hasn't done much on offense. Certainly that they didn't have help on, for sure. They got their two scoring drives. They got the ball at the 22 of St. Thomas and then at midfield. So Linfield's needing a drive here, and they start off at their own 21-yard line. Get down into Tommy territory, down to about the 24, 23-yard line, and Bomey just drops a shotgun snap, completely misses it. It skips off his hands. He's got to fall on it back at the 36-yard line, and with the field goal adventures from earlier, a long field goal is not an option. They have to go for it on fourth down and 14, and they get nothing out of it. So St. Thomas here takes over with about 3.5 minutes left. Linfield has Linfield has two timeouts remaining at this point. Call both of them. St. Thomas unable to convert a first down, so they punt the ball away, and Linfield starts at its own 36-yard line with 2:07 left and out of timeouts. And it's just a great drive. It's all, of course, because it's a 2-minute drill and they're out of timeouts. It's all passes. Bomey does a great job, and then on fourth down from the 7-yard line, hits the touchdown pass with 17 seconds left to tie the game at 17. So we go to overtime. Linfield gets the ball first. 5-yard illegal procedure penalty on the first play out of the gate. 3 incomplete passes. And then they bring out, on fourth and 15 from the 30-yard line, they bring out Jordan Walker, who's now missed two relatively chip shot field goals, a 30-yarder and I think a 33-yarder. They bring him out for a 47-yarder straight on down the middle of the field, and he leaves it short. And then St. Thomas takes over, obviously just needing to score three to win the game, and they fumble on the first play from scrimmage. So we go to the second overtime. This is the one where St. Thomas gets the ball first, and we end up with a Dakota Tracy makes a turns a broken play into a touchdown, finding Fritz Waldvogel running across the back of the end zone for six, and it ends up 24-17 with St. Thomas with the lead. So Linfield needs to get seven to tie or eight to win. Bohme gets a complete pass to Deidre Wiersma for about half the distance down to the end zone on the first play from scrimmage. And then on the second play, Averett is churning for extra yards, had gotten about 7 yards on the play, and has the ball knocked loose by Brady Irvin, recovered by Willie Barigi, and that's the way this epic ball game ends, with St. Thomas forcing a fumble. It's just two takeaways that St. Thomas had on the afternoon, and they were pretty far between. They gave the ball away five times, but they got the last one when they needed it, and won 24-17 in double overtime.
Pat, there isn't too many times where you're going to lose the turnover battle 5-2 in a playoff game. Your quarterback throws four interceptions, but is still around in overtime to be creative and throw that game-winning touchdown pass. I mean, you got to give a lot of credit, I think, to the St. Thomas defense, you know, for coming in and being put in those bad situations on turnovers. You know, as a defensive player, not only do you get put on short fields sometimes with those turnovers, but you go to the bench and you take your helmet off, and maybe you get a drink, and you're getting ready to make your adjustments, and you already have to be back out on the field. You don't get to talk about what happened on the last series or the series before. It certainly puts a little bit of pressure on you, but if you want to be a great defense, you have to step up in those situations, and coaches will drill that into their players' heads that, hey, nobody feels sorry for you as the defense when you go in those weird situations. But five turnovers, and St. Thomas managed to survive it. That's pretty impressive, and they had a nice day defensively against Linfield. That was the only game where the total offense was pretty close. All the winning teams had had more total offense than the losing teams, which you would expect. But most of them, there was, in fact, in the seven of the games, there was at least a 100-yard difference. Bethel outgained Wheaton by 106. North Central was outgained Ohio Northern by 105. Those were kind of close. And then St. Thomas and Linfield, St. Thomas outgained Linfield 316 to 283. Now, Linfield only had 57 yards rushing and 226 passing, which is probably not their typical numbers, and certainly I'm sure they wanted to have more than 57 yards rushing. But they were in that game at every point along the way, even though they struggled a little bit, Linfield did. And obviously the turnovers helped, but yeah, I think just from afar, you were there, Pat, you know better than me, but from afar I feel like must have been a great, great defensive effort on the Tommy's part.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. First of all, you know, Linfield quarterbacks had only been sacked a total of 11 times on the season coming into the afternoon, and Bohme was sacked four times. You know, Linfield, as I mentioned, made the good adjustment in terms of switching out Simon Lampson for Taylor Averett, and Averett did get about 4.2 yards a carry. So he did do some good work when he was given the opportunity, but you know, the thing is that you know, Bohme didn't necessarily have time to throw. 226 yards they got passing, but they had to throw 46 times to get that. So that's the yards per attempt is pretty low. That's somewhere in the 5 yard range. And the other thing on the other side of the ball, you came in looking at one of the key guys on the Linfield side of the ball, on the Linfield defense, Eric Hedin, who had 21.5 sacks coming into the afternoon and 30 plus tackles for loss, and he was really kept off of Dakota Tracy the entire afternoon. He did get one sack, but you know, a combination of first of all, Tracy being a mobile quarterback and putting his legs to good use. And you know, a quality St. Thomas offensive line really limited his effectiveness. They were more effective against the run. I know that St. Thomas would like to have run for more than 156 yards and 3 yards a carry if they'd been given the option. But you know, that was where things really worked well for Linfield. St. Thomas saw its run game, I want to say, shut down, because they ran it 49 times, but they didn't have a whole lot of success in the run game.
Well, that was the major key, too, on Saturday for really all across the nation. The teams that had success in the run game won, and the teams that didn't have success didn't win. And I don't know if that's just an indication of being able to establish your will or getting out to early leads and trying to hang on to them. But in that case, Pat, in your game, the St. Thomas Linfield game, probably, I wasn't going to say the best game in the country of the eight on Saturday, but certainly Whitewater Trine gave it a run for its money. And then this other game in the same region, where Bethel and Wheaton, the winner of that game, was going to play the winner of the St. Thomas Linfield game, that turned out to be a pretty great game too.
Yeah, Bethel ends up beating Wheaton 15-10, and Wheaton driving but unable to convert a fourth down and keep that game alive. And we mentioned, and of course we wrote about it on the site too, Keith, that these teams have certainly met before. And had similar battles, obviously not in the second round of the playoffs necessarily, but you know, Bethel did a couple of things that I thought was interesting. First of all, literally, Adam Johnson and I did a double take in looking at the live stats for that game and saw that Bethel not only attempted a field goal but made it. You know, this is a team that hasn't kicked a field goal in I don't know when the last one was they made. The last one that they attempted, I saw against St. Thomas, and from the looks of that field goal, I could see why they hadn't tried one in the 4 weeks since. But they kicked a 27-yard field goal, which, you know, if your kicking game is a little iffy, that's a bit of a gamble. That's more than an extra point, and they had been even passing up extra points in recent weeks. But you know, it's Logan Flannery's career continues. You know, he's a guy who's been on the radar ever since Bethel's playoff run back in his freshman year, and he had 30 carries for 141 yards. And Aker, the quarterback, had only 78 yards passing, but he had another 61 yards rushing. And Bethel survives and goes on to play St. Thomas, who we'll come back to. I'll let you talk about Bethel Wheaton in a second, but just to talk about the St. Thomas guys' reaction to playing Bethel again, they always said they like preparing for Bethel because they know they're going to get good, pure smash-mouth football, and it's a lot of fun to prepare for, even if you end up with a few extra bruises at the end of the week.
But Pat, I know Wheaton feels the same way, too. You know, Wheaton is familiar with playing Bethel from not in this regular season, but the two regular seasons prior, and they know what Bethel does. It's nothing outlandish. You know, they just like to line up and play good, tough, hard-nosed football, which, you know, sounds like a cliche, but that's exactly what they do. You know, they play good defense, and they like to run the ball. You got a guy that can carry 30 times for you at this point in the playoffs. You know, you're going to run him 30 times, and Logan Flannery certainly, he didn't earn his paycheck or scholarship, so I don't have a cliche for that one, but he earned his respect on Saturday. How about that? You know, 30 carries in the playoffs, and we, as nice as we were, as complimentary as Lavelle Coppedge's performance, as we were with the 38 carries, you know, there's nothing easy about carrying it 30 times. And you saw Austin Dwyer, too, for Alfred. He had 32 carries. So if you got a guy at this point in the year, you know, that's just that good, you ride him. And Bethel trailed at this game, at the half, 7-0, and needed to put together some long drives in the second half. You know, the score was 15-10, but it was 10-9. Wheaton took a lead with about 12 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, made it a 10-9 game. And so Bethel was coming from behind, and they don't have the opportunity, or they don't have the in their arsenal the big, you know, the spread offense with three or four great wide receivers that can go up and down the field. You know, they have to put together a drive, and they have to keep the other team off the field. They have to play a little bit of the field position game sometimes, but they did a really nice job on Saturday in the second half, coming from behind, winning that game 15-10. You know, you mentioned the short field goal, but you get down to the 10-yard line, you have to get some points out of it. So 27-yard field goal is what they needed at the end of the third quarter, and it was a nice win for Bethel in the sense that they get a chance now to avenge their only loss of the season, a 10-6 loss to St. Thomas. It was a heartbreaker at the time for them. but it'll feel a whole lot better if they're able to avenge it here in the round of eight.
Yeah, and one thing which I know we've mentioned on previous podcasts, but I'll just touch on it again before we leave this game, is just a reminder that Mitch Hallstrom, who is the leading receiver and a freshman for Bethel, didn't play, wasn't on campus in the St. Thomas meeting the first time around. Now I see he didn't get a catch on Saturday, but they only completed seven passes to begin with. His sister got married the day of the first St. Thomas meeting. I'm pretty sure he won't be missing the second one.
No, and you know, if they need a play in the passing game, he certainly emerged as a guy to go to. And as you see these teams in the playoffs, you know, Mary Hardin-Baylor is the other one that's still alive that pretty much is going to run the ball, you know, four times out of five or something like that. I mean, a very run-dominated offense. Bethel's going to be the same way. Got to have somebody in the passing game just to offset it a little bit, just to keep the defense honest. And if you feel those guys creeping up, then you can come over the top. Or if you find yourself in a third and long, third and 12, third and 15, you have a guy who can make that play for you. And if Mary Hardin-Baylor and Bethel, you know, if they're able to mix a little bit of passing in on Saturday, they'll have a chance against St. Thomas and Wesley.
Let's talk about Mary Hardin-Baylor and Wesley. These are the two blowouts of the brackets that we haven't really talked about them so much, and we kind of pushed them to the back because, first of all, these two are going to be squaring off in a pretty hotly contested playoff battle in the quarterfinals. But Mary Hardin-Baylor just cruising past Thomas More. I know they turned the ball over on the first play of the game, but they were in the end zone at the 11:51 mark. It was 38-0 by the time they got to half. And, you know, at that point, you pretty much name your final score. It ended up being 69-7.
And Pat, that continues the history of basically Mary Hardin-Baylor, but of American Southwest Conference teams beating President's Athletic Conference teams in the playoffs. And some of them have been pretty bad beatings. You know, you go back 2 years ago, the UMHB beat Washington Jefferson, I think it was 63-7, in a similar situation where it was a round later in the playoffs, but W&J had come off this great upset of Millsaps, and we thought maybe they were going to go down to Texas and give them a game, and it wasn't anything like that. And you can go back to 04, there was a 52-16 game between Mary Hardin-Baylor and W&J. And so each time a Pac team comes, starts building up its reputation and wins a few playoff games, and we start thinking they may be one of the teams in the South to look out for, they go down to Belton and get a real wake-up call. And that's what happened to Thomas More on Saturday. You know, 769 yards of offense, 522 rushing. And you almost have to point to that first series, Pat, where you mentioned it. You know, even if Thomas More scores there, you know, doesn't make up a 62-point difference, but it gives them some momentum. Instead, though, Thomas More gets the ball, great field position, and Mary Hardin-Baylor blocks that field goal attempt early in the game, and then, you know, runs off four touchdowns and five touchdowns and a field goal before the half to put the game out of reach. So, I mean, Mary Hardin-Baylor, and really in all phases of the game, you know, you praise when you see a 69, you praise the offense, but they did a good job of limiting Thomas More. They only rushed for 75 yards, and they're bringing a pretty complete team up to Delaware on Saturday.
There's a lot of stats that you could point out on the offensive side. You mentioned the gaudy total offense number, 769 yards of total offense. Mary Hardin-Baylor ran for 522 yards and the five touchdowns, and they had four players with 100 yards or more rushing. Quincy Daniels, Steven Salinas, DJ Monroe, and Leo Gutierrez, the third-string quarterback, four carries for 102 yards and two scores, including a 69-yarder.
That's the tough thing about Mary Hardin-Baylor is if you run the ball and you run it, you have a run-based offense, you can't call off the dogs at any point. You know, you can't kneel it out every play. So their second-string and third-string offense gets in the game, and if they're running that offense to perfection and it's still humming at that point, you know, that's how you run up numbers like 769, 69 points against a really top 25 team probably in Division III, or, you know, maybe not one of the 25 strongest, but they're going to finish in the top 25. Thomas More certainly is and had a great season up to this point. You know, 11 wins, it's hard to, I mean, that's the drawback, I think, with the playoffs is, you know, you get to sort it out on the field, but a lot of great seasons are going to end on tough Saturdays. Now, two numbers from that box score, Pat, that we didn't pull out, that we definitely need to mention, because Mary Harden Baylor is not going to be able to get away with 14 penalties and 4 turnovers on Saturday against Wesley. They're just not going to be able to overcome that, setting themselves back like that. If they get into that sort of situation, it's going to end up being a bad result. They need to clean up that part of their game before they go up to Delaware. You know, from afar, watching Mary Harden Baylor this season, they've really found some unconventional ways to win. And, you know, Wesley is familiar with everything that they do, and vice versa. You know, these guys have played about as much as a team from Texas and Delaware could play. You know, the Mary Harden Baylor and Wesley now pretty much rivals in the South region. This is going to be, I guess, since 05, really, it's been where they started playing for the South Region Championship. Sometimes they played earlier in the playoffs, but they're pretty much the class of the South Region at this point.
Yeah, Keith, my notes at this point in the podcast say, throw to Keith to talk about the Wesley-Montclair State game.
Well, look, this is pretty simple to break down. I'll try not to take as long as you took to run down the whole St. Thomas-Linfield game. There was really one blueprint, I think, for Montclair State to beat Wesley. Montclair State is a great defensive team, and they like to control the clock by running the ball and throwing short passes. They weren't able to establish the run any way whatsoever. And then their quarterback, Tom Fisher, hurt his thumb or his hand somehow, it looked like. You know, we weren't able to get confirmation on exactly what happened, but very early in the game, hurts his hand on a play. You could see him crouching over and grabbing his hand. And then next play, he tries to throw it out, and it's open, but the pass floats. You know, his hand obviously wasn't perfect. Marcus Wilson, the cornerback for Wesley, steps in front, takes it back 52 yards for a touchdown, and sort of from there the route is on. You know, there was another opportunity right before the half. Montclair State was down 20, had a chance going in to make it 20-7, and somebody ran the wrong route. Fisher threw to a spot. It was like a quick slant, and then a quick out. He threw the slant way inside, and it was picked off by Sean Scanlon, free safety for Wesley. And either the route was run too short, or Fisher was supposed to throw to the out, and he was thrown to a spot on the slant. In any case, throws an interception right around the goal line, and instead of being 20-7 going into the half, Wesley's able to get a field goal right before the half, which in the wind at Dover was pretty remarkable kick. I think it was 46 yards, and it was low trajectory. You know, perfect kick for the way the wind is there, and he'd missed an extra point earlier, so it was a nice kick for Justin Tryon. They go in 23-0. They score the first drive of the second half. It's 30-0. The route is on. Montclair State basically just at no point during the game was ever able to establish its run game. They had pretty good back all season in Jimenez. And just weren't able to get him going, and then weren't able to keep Wesley off the field. And we'll talk a lot about Wesley's stars on offense. You'll know some of these names. Brandon Wright now is the featured back, and Wesley has, you know, remember they used to do as many, you know, 4 or 5 different guys spreading their carries in the backfield. They just have Brandon Wright now. You know, they don't give too many other guys carries, so they have one featured back. They have a big, tall receiver in Ellis Kraut. They have a lot of the other receivers that they like to get the ball to streaking down the field or in, you know, quick screen situations in Leonard Stevenson, DeAndre Folks, guys like that. They have a varied offense, and they're going to be tough to stop. But got to give that defense some credit. Held Montclair State to -5 yards rushing, 113 yards total on Saturday. And they are statistically the number one ranked defense in the country. You know some of the stars off that defense, Pat, because you've seen them play before. It's almost all the same guys back, and it's going to be real, real tough for anybody to score on Wesley.
The history of Wesley Mary Harden Baylor was 4 consecutive years in the playoffs. They didn't meet last year because they were set up on opposite halves of the bracket. But 2005, Wesley wins 46-36. 2006, Wesley wins 34-20. And then in 2007 and 2008, Mary Harden-Baylor got the upper hand. They won 27-10 and 46-14. So, first of all, this is you know, not only the rubber match of the best of 5 series, but you know, Mary Harden-Baylor's had a little bit of the upper hand. But I think that if you asked the Division III conventional wisdom, I think people would say that Wesley currently right now might be the better program, but not by very much.
This is when you find out who the better program is. You know, there's not enough interplay in Division III to really know, you know, who's the better program. And when we go a little bit off last year, we go on what Wesley's done this year. They've been the more dominant of the two. You know, Mary Hardin-Baylor has had to survive a couple games. They had to, you know, break up a pass in the end zone to beat Louisiana College. They had to hold on a little bit early in the season, although they've been fairly dominant the past 5 weeks, Mary Hardin-Baylor has. I mean, they haven't played a close game since early in the season. And Wesley's been just pretty much dominant from start to finish. They had a couple big tests in beating playoff teams in Salisbury and in Delaware Valley. So both these teams, you know, had their tests during the season. And yeah, you feel like the conventional wisdom is Wesley's the more complete team. But you just don't know until you see the game, you know. When we talk about, you know, I'm just going back to what we said in the very beginning about Alfred having the opportunity to put its program on the map. The first time Wesley played Mary Hardin-Baylor, they went down there, and we didn't expect Wesley to win. Wesley was just a team that was kind of in the playoffs, and it was like an 8-win, you know, team in the East, you know, South region. Sometimes they would get in, you know, they weren't automatic, and then they went down there and won that game, and then they beat Mary Hardin-Baylor the next season, and all of a sudden they're a semifinal type of team, they're a power team, and they keep that going every year. You know, that's the opportunity that every team gets in the playoffs. The deeper you get in, you're one of the last eight standing. You have this opportunity to join that group. And Wesley and Mary Hardin-Baylor, they're trying to join another group. And you know what group that is, the top two. They're trying to join the group of teams that go to Salem. And that's what everybody's playing for here. And I know everybody that's listening knows that. But it's so simple, and yet it's so profound in a way, because you're playing for everything you dream for, you know, and it just comes down to that one Saturday. And as fans, we're so blessed to be able to watch it unfold, because I think we have at least three really epic playoff games shaping up on Saturday. You know, really potentially games for the ages. When you talk about this St. Thomas Bethel rematch, the first game was 10-6. You talk about all the subplots with Whitewater having to go on the road to North Central, and both of those teams being really, really strong physically. And then you have Wesley and Mary Hardin-Baylor, the history. Now their fifth meeting. They're 2-2 against each other. And whichever one wins here is going to have an opportunity to go on and face one of those two power teams from the North region with a chance to go to Salem on the line. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
We're going to have one of those setups on Saturday where we've got two games starting at noon, two games starting at 1 o'clock. So we're going to know half of the bracket, so to speak, early on. It won't be the same half of the bracket. It'll be two semifinalists, one in each of the two matchups, and then we're going to have two games, which should be two really good games, ending up late. I don't know, hopefully maybe we'll have a snowstorm that knocks one of those back an hour or lengthens a halftime so we get a little bit more of a staggered starter end. But we still got a good, solid, long block of time where we're going to have great competitive football on Saturday.
And you guys, you know, if you're this deep in the podcast, you're familiar with D3Football.com. You know the drill. We'll be everywhere we can be on Saturday. We got everything on the scoreboard page. We'll be on Twitter. And you can live that hour. I enjoy it, and I imagine if you're a diehard fan, either of one of the eight teams that's alive or one of the 220-some-odd teams that now, I guess 230 teams, right, whose seasons are over, but you're still interested in the playoffs, you know, you follow along with us. We will have every detail that is available on these games, you know, available for you as soon as possible. There'll be, if I'm not mistaken, Pat, video on these games as well as audio.
Well, let's. I'm looking at what's going to happen here. We're hoping to help produce video at Wesley on Saturday. North Central has its own video. I wouldn't say St. Thomas's broadcast really qualifies as video. I think they need to do some upgrades to the bandwidth, because they've had some real issues with it, but there will be broadcasts everywhere, and then Mount Union doesn't do video of its home games unless you have television and are willing to wait on tape delay. But I'll do my best to Twitter during the game. I'll be calling the North Central Whitewater game, but you know, like I did Saturday, if you were like Adam Johnson standing next to me, I'm literally typing out the tweet as I'm saying it on air, doing a quick recap of the game so that I don't confuse myself while I'm typing my 140 characters just to keep everything going at the same time. But yeah, that's what you'll have. It'll be, you know, from noon Eastern until about 4 o'clock or so Eastern time will be the time when it all comes down. It should be a great 4 hours of football. And we'll have playoff previews and features throughout the week. Of course, don't forget voting for the fan vote for the Gagliardi Trophy ends on Tuesday, the 30th this week. So if you haven't voted and you only get one ballot, if you haven't voted, stop by our voting page and cast your ballot for the for your top player for the Gagliardi Trophy. And if you're a sports information director or a coach listening to this, Tuesday's also the deadline for all-region nominations, and all-region nominations also get considered for D3Football.com All-American. So don't miss out on that. You're now down to the last minute, so don't forget to get that in. And, of course, we'll continue with all the rest of our weekly features. We've got some good Play of the Week candidates in already as well, so it looks like we'll have a Play of the Week, and we'll continue to do that as long as there are plays worthy of being considered, which gets fewer and fewer as the games get fewer and fewer as well.
That about wraps it up, Pat. I mean, we've told you everything we know, I think, about these round of 16 games. Looking forward to the round of 8. Two MIAC teams still left on the board, which is a little bit of a surprise when we had four conferences on Saturday with two teams playing. Only the MIAC was able to get both teams through to the round of 8, so hat tip to that conference. They're only going to have one able to get through another round, but they're guaranteed to have one quarterfinalist. I'm sorry, one semifinalist. And that's a pretty impressive accomplishment for that conference. And I think, you know, of the 8 teams we have left on the board, it's a pretty exciting group. You have some matchups with a lot of intrigue, and even the one that's not, you know, two monster teams against each other. You know, if Alfred surprises Mount Union, then that's a great game. So it's going to be another fun Saturday. You know, these are, if you get bored seeing the same two teams in Salem, then these are the weeks you really want to enjoy as a fan, because the playoffs, you know, we just quartered the field from 32 to 8 teams. But you got great games coming up on Saturday. Really, in all honesty, you know, clear off 1-4 on your schedule, if at all possible, and try to tune in one way or the other. Check these games out.
And so thanks for giving us an hour of your time here on Monday morning or afternoon or Tuesday or whenever you've listened to the Around the Nation podcast. He's Keith McMillan. I'm Pat Coleman, and we'll have more coverage of Division III football throughout the week and the rest of the season.